I think we'll get started. Thanks for coming to my session on rolling out DNN within a large corporate. When I was thinking about what sessions to submit to DNN Connect this year, I thought I would submit one that was less technical and one that was more technical. So this is the less technical session, so there's not much coding or anything in this one. It's more about what I've been working on over the last few years in the US. So just more about the sessions, broken up into four major areas. The first one is building a community site, which is where we started at with F5 Networks, building a marketing site, a partner site, and then eventually a storefront for some of their digital products and that. So a little bit about myself. Some of you already know, some may not know my involvement in DNN. I was pretty heavily involved early on. I co-wrote some of the original books there. I'm based out of Australia, which is 1 hour south of Sydney, and that's a photo of where I live. So I live along the coast. It's a port, and it's got a big steelworks, and up in the hills and that there, lots of coal mines and that there, so it's very easy to make steel when you've got all the ingredients very close by. I've been involved in the DNN community since the iBuySpy days. I made a number of modifications to that and sent them through to Sean, and then they got integrated into the core, and then it turned into DNN, and then spent a lot of time working and enhancing DNN and then using it for my own projects. Eventually, the support got too much to keep offering my modules for free, so that's when I started Venturian. Some of you may have used my modules in the past, like Property Agent or News Articles, Simple Gallery, just to name a few there, and they were quite popular for quite a number of years on the platform. A little bit about F5 Networks. A lot of people have never heard of them, but if you've used the internet today, you've probably skipped across quite a few of their devices. They're the market leaders in what's known as application delivery networking. So these are devices that sit in front of applications and securely deliver them. Originally, it started out as a long time ago, just as a load balancer, and most people knew it as a load balancer, but it's much more than that today. These devices do everything from security, SSL offloading. One of the examples I always like is the cloud bursting example, where if you're running these devices across multiple data centers or just a single data center, and you get a ton of traffic come in that hits a certain threshold, these devices, they're all programmable. They're capable of spinning up other devices to handle that load and then shutting them down when they're finished. So it's a highly programmable network device that sits in front of your applications to deliver them. The major clients in that are these are very expensive devices. So the major clients are big ISPs, telco service providers, banks, the governments, military, health, and that. These are for very large organizations. They come, we make specialized hardware, so you can get them the physical box. So you may have seen them in a data center, a little red ball on there. I've got a photo on the next slide. Or there are virtualized solutions and that now. And there are plenty of services in that as well, which we offer, things like DDoS protection and that sit in front of your applications that are not so much tied in the traditional products. Their footprint is pretty big. So the Fortune 50 companies, 48 companies are our customer. So it's really in that high end of the market, these devices. When I first started a few years back, their revenue was around the $1 billion mark. They celebrated hitting that in 2012 or 13, and their revenue's up to 1.92 now. And they're adding roughly about 400 to 500 employees a year, and that, so it's growing quite fast. It's a one of those things where there's just more applications and more demands on those applications and our devices, and that can help scale those applications out. So this is what a Viprion device looks like. If you ever see them in the data center or that red F5 ball, you'll know it's an ADC, an application delivery controller. And basically that's delivering applications like it could be using the, it's got different programmable modules in there. So it could be just the local traffic manager, which is looking after a web farm or all that. So, their position in the network, in the market is, this was the Gartner ADC Magic Quadrant. So they rank everyone in this sector. And it shows F5 way up in the right-hand side where the leaders are, and then down. So there's ability to execute, which goes up, and then completeness of vision, which is down here. And then so the further you are up into that right-hand corner, that the better. So there's quite a degree of separation now. To give you an example, this was a few years ago. So we see F5 Networks and Cisco and that. So we're beginning to push even higher, and then some of those competitors have disappeared or pushed back into the middle and that now. And I'm not an expert on the actual technology side of things. I was brought in as a DNN person to look after their CMS because they had a community site. So I don't, if you ask me a lot of questions at that, they're more questions for network engineers and that, but I know a lot of the marketing content and that we put out. But now the challenge, when I first started at F5, it turns out these devices are highly programmable, which means you can sit on the network and then when the packets of data are going across, you can program against that, inspect that data, manipulate it. You can do quite a lot of things. You can orchestrate, you know, the cloud bursting example that I gave earlier. So they're highly capable, just like DNN is. But there's a huge amount of information required to know how to use the devices properly. So there's a developer website that was needed for F5. So they spun one up in 2004, 2005. I'm not sure the exact date. I had to go back to the first person registered on the site, and it was a DNN site. So a network engineer within F5 had downloaded DNN, downloaded the forums and that at that time, and news articles, which was my module, and basically set up a box, and then he stuck it underneath his desk, and he built a community for F5. It was a very small company then, build a technical community, the same way DNN sort of fostered up, about Q&A, blog posts and that. He built a community around there, and they needed a way to publish out their API documentation. So that became also the base repository for that. These devices weren't programmable going back just before that time. F5 was the first company to make these devices. They had a scripting technology which sits on top of it, and they really innovated in that area. And now majority of the vendors have that, but this is where this need for a community site came out of. And we can see the content types there. So they needed API documentation. The blogs were like an evangelism section for members of staff to talk directly to the community. It was a very open company. They allowed a lot of people to use that as a platform to put out their ideas. And it's more about that evangelism, just overall networking concepts at the blog level. At the article level, which I know article and blogs are the same thing, but they broke them out at that stage. And then they would actually have tech tips, which they called tech tips, and that were very technical things. Here's what you can do on the platform. Yeah, here's how you do this, here's how you do that. They had code samples. Same way that we share code samples, they were able to copy and paste. These are network engineers as well, so they're not programmers by nature. So they found this like we find Stack Overflow in that today. So they needed to share a lot of snippets and that between each other. And they also began to invest in things like recorded and live video. They had a podcast and that as well for a while. So I can show you what the site looked like in 2008. So you can see it's a very very simple site. You can sort of tell it's a DNN site. And there's sort of containers and that here. That looked like a standards kind of articles module way back then. And then they just had some navigation elements across the tops. So docs was the API documentation that I was speaking about earlier. You've got blogs, forums, code samples, media, and then some labs and resources at the end. The labs were like pre-configured environments and that they shared. So that's what it looked like in 2008. They versioned it. In 2010, again, you can see, I know Joe's presentation, he's talking about thinking outside the box. This is a very DNN-specific site because you can see there's lots of containers and it's very in-the-box type thinking. We can see latest blogs and that. They actually use a blog platform outside of DNN and integrated into that to show that content. But you can see the content is in very specific channels, the tech tips, the latest blogs. Similar ones at the top, they started to break out into topics. They started to begin to organize their content a lot better. But as we know, some of the older modules and that, and even in today in DNN, unless you're using content items and the global taxonomy, each module sort of has its own group of tags and that go along with it. So it was very siloed, the content, so they had to be really careful to make sure their blogs had a similar taxonomy to their articles, which had a similar taxonomy to the way they handled their API documentation. So that's what it looked like in 2010. So fast forward to 2013, they reached out to me. They were a customer of mine at the time, for all that time back to 2004, 2005. I'd done little bits of work, but I had no idea how big the company and that was. It could have been one person for all I knew. They reached out in 2013. They contracted me to perform some work, upgrade the articles, remove the old blogging software, get rid of that, move it over to the Ventrion articles, work on their SEO. They had very large URLs. You remember the old URL, the tab IDs and that? They had those in there. So we had to implement back, this was back 2013, so this is before Eyefinity got acquired by DNN Corp, to implement that. And then they were running a beta program. So they needed some feedback modules and that, so they could ship out their components, their virtualized components, and then get feedback into the relevant people, but have it feedback come through their community site. At the time, if I go back a slide, there's a user groups one here, and you can sort of see a few tabs and that there. They'd implemented in 2010 Active Social. They wanted to start running user groups and then having the site broken off into those certain sections. And for whatever reason, they expanded that to content and that as well. So they begin to segment their content out. So they had some technologies called, I don't know if it's on here, iRules is the scripting language. It's not a scripting language, but it's the technology that allows you to program these devices. iControl allows you to control it. So I can remote in and configure certain aspects of it, about it. And then there's another one called iApps, which is just pre-configured those two combined. But they, for whatever reason, began to break it out into Active Social. And that had a negative impact on the site because it began to segment users. And they went away from having sort of the forums and that at the top level. When you look back on historical traffic, it was a negative move in that for the site. So, and then there was around the same time that Will sort of began moving to DNN Corp and that as well. So Active Social sort of died as a product over time there. That's what I was speaking about. Content and taxonomy resided in silos. You have to remember these are network engineers that have went and just dropped these modules on the pages. As we know with modules, they seem to have their own data and they keep their own data and they don't share it with other modules and that throughout the site. So what you ended up with is very silo, what I call unstructured data, and that it wasn't if you were designing a site from the start, you'd probably have a common taxonomy and you would adhere to that. And that's what we did. And moving forward, and the design itself was starting to get a bit dated on the site. So we put a proposal forward for new development. This is 2013, so this is just after I come back from DNN World, and this is when it was about DNN 6, when they put the social features and that in. So we've got a community site. It's probably around 80,000 to 100,000 members here, registered members. That's people that have registered on the site. It's not active participants. That's probably a much lower figure. One thing they did do with their API documentation was to gate it, which means you had to register to get to the API stuff. So that sort of boosted those numbers back then. So what we did was put a design proposal forward. This was just some mock-ups and that, but we wanted to restructure the site to make it a bit more social, a bit more focused on the user itself and their experience, so they could begin to tailor, let's say, the journal based on their preferences. Then we'd have some of the event stuff and some of the content that was there before, but just organized in a slightly different way. We'd have like a masthead. We changed the way the categories and that appeared at the top. We focused more on verbs and that, which is what the marketing site was doing at the time, to sort of match in with them. So they liked this approach, and they liked the journal approach. We looked at Evoke Social at that time. It was in beta at this stage, but it wasn't quite ready for us to adopt that yet. So there's another slide here. We have a similar problem on this site in that the technology is quite complex for a beginner to come and grasp what's possible. So similar to DNN, where you have to sort of have a lot of basic tutorials and that, and ramp people up to a certain level. And there was a concept in marketing and that talked about at that stage, zero to hero. So that sort of, we were just messing around with different mastheads and that, and thinking about what actual people wanted when they came to the site. A big change was the forums in Active Social were segmented. So each group had its own forum, and which was a topic. So you'd have a iRules, or you'd have a security, or you'd have an acceleration group, and in that you would have your discussions. But there was buried down in different sections of the site, and you would get quite often pigeonholed into those sections, and it was. And a lot of the time, if you're talking about acceleration, you're probably also talking about iRules or related technology as well. So we wanted to get away from that real deep segmentation and get back to a centralized forum. We did talk about continuing on with the forum and that we had, but we decided a Stack Overflow kind of approach would be a much better fit for the site. Because if you're using a forum, what we found is Hot topics in here, in this forum, is something when a major security vulnerability comes out. That's when typically the community will begin discussing about it first, before we've even thought about an official response and that to it. So things like Heartbleed and that happened a year or two ago, those SSL, those vulnerabilities were really hot topics in that in here. And building something similar to Stack Overflow allowed our users in that to begin to push content up, push answers up. If you're looking at a long forum thread, and let's say it's got 20 pages of content on there, you've got no idea which one's the actual answer. If you use a proper Q&A system like Stack Overflow that I'm sure most people in this room are used to, it's quite easy for the answer to push to the top. So if I'm coming in from the search engine, I see the initial question, any clarifying comments, and then the answer straight there. That didn't happen in the old forums. You would have to go, you'd have to read almost every post going down and then get through to like page 18 or 19 or 20 to get to the final answer. So that was a big proposal from us. And we also, I'll talk a bit more about the leaderboard later, but also ranking our users based on their participation throughout the site. So the first thing we did was redevelop some of the modules. We knew we had to, we weren't going down the Evoke Social path and that because they weren't ready. We knew we had to develop some modules, but we wanted to get away from developing, okay, I'm going to develop an articles module or a downloads module, and they're not going to know anything about each other. We wanted to have some common threads between the content that we populate into both of those modules. Now, in DNN 5.3, there was a feature called content items added into the platform. It's been there for quite a while. And really, until these projects, I hadn't really used it to its full capabilities. But what it does, it allows you to add like a base layer to all the content in your site. So whether you're submitting an article or a download or a code snippet, it allows us to have that base layer. And it handles a lot of things like the title, the content, when it was last updated, who it was created by. All of that data doesn't have to exist in your module's data. All your module has to really do is have a link to, I know I'm this content item. And that's what we begin to build all our modules on. So we begin to organize them on content type. And we had the article itself. We had a very a pattern to the way we did it because not all articles are the same. We had those technical articles, which were the tech tips. But then we also had the bloggers with the evangelism posts and that. So we wanted to differentiate those two. So our content types were configurable inside the module itself. We had videos, questions, comments. So we had this base layer, this repository of content items that we were able to identify by type. And then we looked at the attributes and metadata. Now, DNN shipped with 16 base attributes, and these are things like title, description, language. They're the main ones we use, but there are other ones like, so I think there's a copyright one, there's, I'd have to look them up, but I can't think of the rest at the moment, but they were the main ones. You can extend the number of metadata attributes as well. So we extended it with a couple extra things like URL, which is the slug that was generated, are stored down at that level. Also down at the content item level is the taxonomy. So if you go into the taxonomy in DNN or the lists and that and see the list of tags, you can define your own custom taxonomy for your site. And these content items correspond to those tags. We associate them down at that level. So when we build out these modules, we end up with a big silo, a big repository of content items of all different types. They all describe themselves in title, description, language, and they've all got a list of tags associated with them, whether it be whether this is a security piece of content or this is an iRules or a cloud service provider. That's what we ended up with. So what we begin to do is build those modules, and we ended up with, as of the other day, 235,000 content items. So that's everything from a question, a comment, a post. That's how many we have in the system. So what we could do from there is when we redesign the site, we could set up pages. This one here is the IAPS page. What we can do then is have a module which we call a content aggregator, which we drop on the page, and we say, you know what, here, I want you to use this Razor template, and I want you to pull out all articles of this type that are tagged IAPS and display them there. And these pages just began to build themselves because all we were doing was configuring a viewport onto these content items. Same for the answers here. Show us what's happening in Q&A here. And again, it's just filtering out, okay, I'm going to pick that content type of Q&A or questions or answers, show me the questions and answers. Even things like the upvotes and that, which you can't really see there, that's stored down at the metadata level as well. So we've got access to that down there. So we can sort it by popular in there. So those pages begin to build themselves. Down the left-hand side, that was our new taxonomy. So we had two major pivots. We had a security, a cloud, a DevOps, and an app delivery. Before that, it was kind of like the Wild West on the site. They had about 8 or 9 different tags, but it wasn't used consistently throughout the site, and it was at differing levels. And that, so that was, we're implementing a community site, but we also have to play nice into the corporate structure of information. So that's what came down to us, is that's how we're going to organize our content. So when people ask us for content, we can say, here, sure, you can have all our articles on security, or you can have all our ones on iRules or iWorkflow. So that for us was a big win. Now, I'll give you a look at our content aggregator module. It's a very, very simple module. It's got three modes. The first one is dynamic. The dynamic mode is something you just drop the module on the page. You pick what content types that you want. So that was the, let's say we wanted the Q&A or we wanted the articles. You can pick the tag, what language it needs to be in, whether it's featured. That's another extension to the metadata attribute there, and what state and that it's in, whether it's in draft or published. Whether you want it settings, you know, what do you want it, what do you want it sorted by, what template. So it's very simple, dynamic mode. As we begin to build things, in some spots on the site, we realized we wanted to hand-pick items, and sometimes the dynamic wasn't granular enough, so we built an interface where we could search the content item repositories, search it by type, by title, and select them over here, and that allows us to hand-place things on the page. So that worked really well for us. And the final mode was social. That allowed us to pick a template, but then also supply some other information, and it would pull data in from some social networks, so Twitter and things like that, which would say, show me all the ones that come from Twitter, use this Razor template, and they come with this tag. So that was just another mode. So this module built a lot of the site besides those few primary pillars around articles and Q&A. That's what we used extensively. So what that also allowed us to do was to relate content. So if I have an article on a page and it's got a set number of tags, I can also then say, show me the other articles in this big repository, the 235,000 items that we have, with similar tags, and sort them by the most recent. So we would end up with things like that we could drop on the side of the page or below an article. It knows what content item's getting rendered, and then it can it knows how to match those items there. So another item we're able to do with the content aggregator was stealing what I'm going to talk about later, but on f5.com, we eventually redeveloped that, but what we were able to do was begin to pull content cross-portal as well. So if I'm on a product page talking about our security products, I can say, come to the go to the community site's repository of information, pull out all our security articles, the most five recent and the ones that are featured, and this is what you end up with. So you're going to pull in some dynamic data, even to sort of some bland product pages, and that. So some of the gotchas that we had with content items. There's no active state in there. I know I talked about state before, but we had to fudge it. There's no like flag to say this is a draft content item. We had to manipulate it, and we've got like an additional content type that we use for state for each one there. There was no cacheability of metadata down on the base content item, but we were able to extend the content item class and add our own cacheability layer at that level. But it was still worth it because it saved us a lot of time, saved us not only in the implementation of building a Q&A module, but it also allowed us to use something like the content aggregator to aggregate it not only through our own site, but then offer it to everyone else as well. So from content items, we moved on to talk about gamification. Now, on the existing site, it had gamification built in Active Forums, I think it was. Remember the points that used to be there? So it had a little bit there, but we wanted something, again, not just for one module, but across all modules. So we talked about building a gamification layer that all modules can begin to create their own actions, and we would end up with a point system that moderators can modify and tweak the game as it gets played. So the first quote up there, for those who don't know what gamification is, but it's it just talks about adding the elements of game playing into say a regular site or any regular marketing activity. I mean, in this conference here, we could add a particular game element to this by adding, let's say, reputational points and that for how many sessions you attend, like how many you check in, You might earn speaker points and that. So it's applicable in a number of areas. Things like Khan Academy and that uses gamification throughout their site to unlock skill trees and that. So when I progress through certain stages, then more content becomes available to me. So you can use it in a number of ways. The competition for us, we have an MVP award for the site, similar to the way the DNN MVPs work. And it's quite a prestigious award in the sense that they all get flown out and they have like an annual summit and that, similar to the Microsoft one, but on a much, much smaller scale. And these game mechanics and that play into not the total result, but just have an influence on it. So what we did was talk about, this is a very minute number of our rules. It's much longer than this, but this is to give you a small example of some rules that we had for Q&A. So we awarded 1 point for asking a question on reputation. Whether it's voted up, you add 10, and when it gets voted down, you take away 2. Now, it's important that, and my personal philosophy is to not reward people just for creating content. Some people had their bonus objectives and that in the old Dev Central tied up with how many evangelistical articles and that they put into the site. So what they would do is they would go to a conference like this, they would shoot some video, and then they would break that video up into 5 posts. Like they would have phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, talking about different things. So I don't like rewarding people too much for just submitting content. It's much better to get the social signals and that coming back out, whether it's voted up, vote down. That's how you control that and get the best out of the system. Now, this experience points is an additional lever internally that we use for gamification, that we can measure all of these actions differently. I've got a slide that up further that talks about it, but everyone was focused on how much content was being submitted into the site, how many page views, and that. And for a community site, I don't think that's the most accurate metric. So we had an internal metric that we used to add up some of the actions and that, so we get some of the activity that happens on our site week to week. So more on gamifications. This is how we rank people. So on the left-hand side is the leaderboard. You can see some of the accumulation of points. The guy in first there, he's a network engineer, network support engineer on the east coast of the US and that, and he spends a lot of time on our site. He's probably our version of Sebastian. So he spends a lot of time and he's always like one of the first ones to respond. And so you can see that's why there's a huge point difference between him and everyone else. This is an example of some of the interface. So these are the comments on the answers. They vote up, vote down. Pretty standard stuff that you see on Stack Overflow. This is something that Aaron and that helped out with, the profile. Not this one. The profile is coming up soon. Here is the MVP program that I talked about. There are MVPs down the left-hand side. How many points, how many questions, and that they answer, and that. It's a much larger page, but I just thought I'd give you a snapshot of how we use it to influence our MVP selection. And this next slide is briefly what I touched on before about people being very focused on page views, user registrations, and content created. So when they have their board meetings and that, and gets reported the shareholders and that, what gets reported is the user registrations, which is important, but when you, I think a much better metric is, an additional metric is looking at how much reputation is earned throughout the site or how much is experience is earned, because experience is just a different lever that we use, and that's more important to us to see this keep going up, because that tells us that people are more engaged in the site. When you see that drop away, that means people are not performing, you know, in there submitting questions, upvoting questions, adding answers, and that. So I think that's a much better metric than things like page views, because I can go on to the blog post and I can research and say what blog post is going to get me the most page views, and I can write about something like, I know for our site, a guy wrote a PowerShell one, and it was about a topic that I didn't have much content on the internet, but it was a topic that a lot of people searched for, and his article was way up to the top. That's why I don't agree with using page views as the best metric on that. Reputation and then experience is the best metric. And again, that's just an additional lever. I have a talk tomorrow specifically about gamification. There's a little bit of coding in that in it, but and in the end, I'll give out the gamification API that we use here, and you'll get a much better view on how reputation experience can be used. One negative was the social experiment that didn't work. I mentioned, if you remember back to the original mock-up, it had the journal feed and that there. What we found when we implemented the journal feed was, this is a technical community similar to us. I mean, you wouldn't go onto dnn.com and post status updates and share links and things like that. Like, we had that on the homepage to start with, so we found people didn't do that. We found comments on journal entries were separate to comments on, let's say, an article post. They existed in two different places, so you had to try and match them together, which was difficult and that at the time. So, and we found when we scaled up, we're at about over 250,000 registrations now, and we have a large number of like user groups and that on the site. We found the performance was not very good once we got to those numbers in the journal module. It seemed to be fine if we had restricted the number of groups, but as soon as that rolls really spread out, that trying to build that customized wall caused us quite a bit of problems. What we're able to do was use content aggregator again, because all we're looking at is content that a user has created, and we can style it in a certain way, because we know this one is a question. We know, okay, in the Razor template, oh, this is a question, let's style it this way. This is a comment, let's style it that way. And we could simulate what the journal feed looked like, and that was our compromise there. So as of today, this is what it looks like here. This is the homepage. This is sort of the reputation console there, because I'm logged in at the moment. You can see my reputation at the top. I'm not a very active user on the site, and you can see we've kept the same taxonomy down the left-hand side. They wanted a slider. Again, we just use Content Aggregator to build virtually the entire homepage, and we fully cache that out. That's the advantage of also the journal module was not cacheable, because it's dynamic per user and that as well. So we found we couldn't really gain much performance on the homepage, probably where it's the most critical. Answers, so that's what it looks like there. That's Q&A. It's had a few different variants. The latest one, they wanted the checkboxes down the side so you can begin to filter, and it builds a filter list across the top. You see the number of views, the answers, and that there. It's really very similar to what Stack Overflow and that does. We found it really increased participation and that. But one thing when you're implementing this in a very active community is that your moderators need to be on point to be making sure that they're closing down duplicate threads and that. So it really becomes a huge knowledge repository rather than a very unorganized mess. And then this is the user profile. This is one of the other modules. This is an extension. It's a custom module that we did to represent user profiles. And then this is one element of it, which is the user dashboard, which is, tells us how your points in that are calculated up. There's a graphs view that you can switch to. I can go to the contributions tab at the left-hand side, and it shows me grouped up how many articles I've submitted, how many questions, and that. So, and again, it's just using that content aggregator module on there. And then we can have personal information and that. And the MVPs we've talked about, we can skip past that. So after we did the community site, the rest of the marketing was pretty impressed, because we were able to boost the numbers up, and it began to look like the rest of the company. We always had a very strong user base. It was just more about tidying it up and getting our house in order. So what they entrusted us with next was to look at migrating this site, which is the marketing site, f5.com. Again, you see there's verbs at the top, solve it, believe it, build it. Marketing at the time decided that's the way they wanted to build their navigational structures. It wasn't a responsive site. It had the big banner and all that there. And it had Tech Talk as the integration to our community site way back when. So it wasn't mobile. But that look and feel didn't go down too low either. It sort of bled into the old site. So there was still a lot of work to be done on that site. So we proposed using the multi-tenant capabilities within DNN to bring this site in, begin to share a more larger repository of content. It was running on Adobe CQ. We also promised that we could get the site into 9 languages at the time, so not just English. And we also gained the user sharing across the different site groups and that as well, because the marketing site didn't have a login. There was a login to the support site, but not to that. And they wanted to begin to customize it more, so that's why they needed that login, and we wanted to consolidate the taxonomy throughout the site. So this is what we ended up, at least from a design perspective, that's what it looks like now. It's a responsive one, so you can collapse it. And that's sort of our first major iteration. And that they consolidated the bar at the top. That bar goes across all F5 properties now. You can see Dev Central, support, partners, careers. They're the main pivots of our F-line, online properties. So what we did from there, so we built the English site. We had to look at the multilingual. And they come down with very specific requirements around multilingual. They wanted to localize all the elements on the page, whether it's the menu, all different content types appearing on F5.com. And just on a side note, when we did build F5.com, we were able to reuse things like Content Aggregator, the Articles module, and all the stuff we'd built on the Dev Central site. And just all the other standard localizable, you know, labels, time formats. The big requirement that they gave us was that the site should fall back to English when the localized content's not available. So they said to us, we don't want to localize down to the bottom level with 5 levels deep. We only want to go 2 or 3 levels deep and then have it fall back. And then they wanted to some more domain variants. So DNN does all this really well. Integration with third-party translation systems. We didn't have many people. We're a global company, so we have people that speak the different languages, but they're not in marketing. They're in sales, they're in support. So we couldn't use those people. We needed to provide some way that we could outsource the content translation. And then we should be able to have some kind of draft state so we could toggle languages on and off when we're developing them. So we looked at the options, and these are the options in DNN today. We could spin up a portal, have one portal per language. The content's not really related at all. We'd have to try and work out a way to share. And the biggest problem with that one is there's no fallback strategy for separate portals. We looked at the DNN content localization, and that one really scared us when we looked at that one, because we were building a large site, and we were just unsure how scalable that was for us, how it was going to keep the sites in sync. And again, it had no fallback strategy. So we already had our own set of modules, so we thought, could we make them language aware? Could we make our own HTML module, extend the core one, and have it have an optional override? So if I'm looking at a certain page and I'm on the French site, if there's French content there, it renders it. If not, fall back to English. So that's what we did there. Downside is that for the most part, you have to have a similar layout between each of the regions. So if you're on the English site or the Spanish site, they look the same. They might have different pictures and things like that, but the layout, the way the structured elements appear on the page are the same. So we got around that, but yeah, for most part, they are the same. So this is what the HTML module looked like. You can't really, you can. Those flags, you can, The ones that are greyed out, they're the ones that haven't been localized yet. The ones that are full color, they're the ones that have got the different languages available for that piece of content. So that's how we built the HTML module. We're able to do this manually, which was great, except we didn't know Japanese or anything else at that time, so we had to figure out a way as how we were going to take all this content and how we're going to get it translated. Were we going to hire someone, have them come in, or were we going to use a third-party system? There's a Spanish site, and if you go to f5.com, there's a language selector down the bottom, and you can just swap between them. So this is where content items saved us again. Again, translation is a resource-intensive process, and we wanted to. There's these marketplaces out there where you can speak to via an API and have them take content, have them have human translators, have a round of translation, and then they'll submit that content back to you once you've approved it. So that's what we did. We used a third-party service called LineBridge. We looked at all our content items, again, the big repository of content items that we had, and we provided what we call a localizer module. So it gave us our site tree and that down the left-hand side. We can't see it here, but it shows us what elements are translated, whether or not that module supports translation. You can click on the flags. There's a few extra nodes there underneath it, but they're not on this screenshot. And it adds it to like a shopping cart. You fill up the shopping cart. You send the order across to LineBridge. They go provide a quote, and then you go through the translation process. Once you're happy with it, you get a notification, and it appears in the orders section. And then you import the content directly back into your site via the content items, and you've got a Japanese site or a Chinese site on there. So that's how we did languages. It turns out that the structured approach to having things similar across the regions works to a certain extent, but it doesn't. Places like Japan and that had quite different views on how they wanted things laid out and that. So we're able to tweak things, which I won't go in because it's a little bit technical, by using some tags and that to hide elements and that on the page, hide modules. And they also wanted custom pages and that as well. So. Yeah, it was a pretty successful project and that for us. Standard bootstrap responsive skin. I mean, this is our first sort of draft at having something responsive and mobile compliant at least. There's a lot of optimization that we can still do here because these are virtually just the desktop views and that on there. But we just wanted a much better way to view the content, specifically in the community site where you were searching for answers and things and that. So, yeah. A couple of other things just about this project. We sit behind the full stack of the F5 products, so those GTM traffic managers and that we talked about before, optimization. We sit in two different data centers, and we have the ability to switch between the two, so we can take one down and make changes in one and then spin it back up. Everything synced cache-wise and that between those two environments too. Core changes, we've made a number of them. We've extended things like the page settings. It's got like a taxonomy section on it now because we use custom dimensions in analytics. So we tag all our pages in that a certain way and all our content a certain way. You've seen the list down the left-hand side so that we can go into analytics and say, show me all the security content or show me the cloud content, show me how that's performing throughout the site, and then we can drill in deeper. I actually want to see content, show me how all of my security articles are performing, or security articles by this user, or security articles in this region, so Europe or whatever. So we had a deploy last night to allow CDN static content delivery automated. That HTML module we have full control over. So we save it in a certain way, and then we use CloudFront to change the path and push it out there to that environment. The site uses a lot of Marketo, which is a marketing engine for all our lead generation. We integrate quite a bit into that. All our forms and that get fed into there. They get qualified in that marketing engine, and then eventually they'll go and annoy the sales team with those leads if they qualify into that into that. So, and then performance, DNN performance is still, you know, it's still an ongoing issue. There's still a lot of scripts and that get generated by default and that out of DNN. So it's still an ongoing item for us and that to try and make the site as fast as possible, especially considering when we localized all this content, we have to go and serve that content from North America to these different regions and that. So that's why we try and get as many of our assets and that into CloudFront and that as we can. So from the marketing site, we'll just quickly go through these last couple. That was the partner site. I spoke about Marketo. This is the custom site for our partners and that to log into. They get things like specific resources that they can use to talk to their own customers. So videos, on the next one, things like a sales play. So it tells us what the playbook is. They use these are very American companies, so they use a lot of football terms and things like that for how they market and that to people. And it allows people to come in, they register their deals and that in there so they can tell how much a particular channel and that's selling for promotions and that. But it's a non-public facing set of content that's how to sell to your end customer. That's what this partner site is. So it's pretty much just all HTML except for a few forms in that which link into Marketo and Salesforce. One thing we had to do was a single sign-on through our support system and F5 University, but that's fairly standard. We did do some Salesforce integration, so all of the countries are very different in Salesforce than what they are in, say, DNN out of the box, so we have to synchronize those lists. And that's we just use scheduled jobs in DNN and then talk through an API to that. And we're able to target regional. We tag our content a certain way. We've got certain theaters that we talk to, and we're able to use that content aggregator module again to target that. And the last slide that we did was a company that we acquired called LineRate, which is a lightweight load balancer. So this is just a software-based load balancer, I think, written on Node. And obviously, we acquired them, and we allowed developers and that to come into here and use it for free up to a certain amount of throughput. And then if you want it higher throughput, it scales up for the different pricing and that there. So we had to build a custom module and that to allow that to happen. And because it goes through our delivery system and that we've got certain delivery system for delivering these files and that. And we had payment authorizations has to go through F5 stuff. So summary. Just to wrap up, the 10 custom modules that we wrote were the articles, code share, which is the snippets, the content aggregator, downloads, wrote a custom forms module just because we needed a lot of Marketo integration, gamification, which is like an API layer, the localizer is what we used to submit to these third-party marketplaces. We wrote a custom login one because we had to do the partners, we had to do the single sign-on between the two, Q&A, and the user profile. We base all our development around two-week sprints. We use Jira and that to map all of those out. Just the last thing, content items are probably the biggest takeaway that we got from these projects and that to they are definitely the basis for a lot of the work that we do as module developers and that now. Tomorrow, I think at 3:30, I'm talking about gamification. So I'll be talking a lot lower level, specifically how we implemented gamification, and then giving out some free code and that at the end. So, any questions? Yeah. Well, it's very simple. I could actually give that out like it's very, very simple module because all it is a selection from Razor templates. And then you're picking from a content item repository. It's virtually like one query that runs the entire module itself. So what the key is that your modules need to create content items. So if you're, and a lot of the modules, especially the older modules and that, content items weren't around or whatever, so they just store all their data in their central repositories. But if you're starting a module now, please use content items, yeah. Yep. Content curation. Yeah, so that's so for the community site, we've got a community team that manages that. So things like Q&A and that, everyone can submit to Q&A if you're a registered member. Thing like articles, you have to be in certain roles and that to submit that. And then when that happens, it goes through an approval process through the Dev Central team to get to the site. We use the... Not everyone, only certain people. Some people that are highly trusted, they can go publish straight out. So we've got a section on f5.com, which is the corporate blog. Only a handful of senior people can post on there. They go straight through. But on the Dev Central site, the Dev Central team can push it out there, but everyone else has to go through that approval process. Because they also look at it and they decide, has it been tagged correctly? You know, is this a really good article? Do we want to feature it? There's a checkbox of feature, and then it appears in different sections of the site as well. Everyone can post a question now. Probably about a year ago, we were having massive spam attacks and that on the site. We were able to use gamification to begin to address those spam attacks. What we were able to do is say to the end users, well, you can post, if you're zero reputation points, you can post one question per hour on there. And so that stopped the spam is just spamming down the list. And then if you went below zero, which is possible, someone downvotes you, you could not post again till you get above zero. We also used Akismet, which is a third-party service, spam checking. It checks IP address and the content itself. And then when you're at low reputation thresholds, you go through Akismet. So, yep, I'm getting told to finish up now. So, yeah, thanks for coming. If you have any questions, just come and see me after or tonight or all that. So, okay.